I think I'll stand up, open it up straight away. Anybody got any comments, questions? So we can have a proper discussion between ourselves.
I just have a couple quick questions. One for Jocelyn. How did you approach these people when you were taking pictures? Did you just take the picture and then tell what was going on?
Friends of friends. I talked to a lot of people I knew. Just about everybody, I was trying to get some contacts with various people. I was lucky. Glasgow, friend of a friend, happened to be a social worker in Bourke. That led to that. The stuff in Cambridge was actually a story on May Week for Swiss Magazine. So I had a week in Cambridge doing May Week, got to know people, got inside it that way. Next, my brother's a social worker down there. So, really working in different ways to try and get intimacy is everything for me. Like Adam, I want to get that inside story.
There was that one picture where there was like an umbrella, and then the girl had her legs wrapped around his head. It looked like you used flash in that picture. Did you take that picture, and did they turn around and be like...
No, I was with them that whole week.
Oh, you were with them?
Yeah, it's the same people in Harrogate. Okay. It was like one group of kids in Harrogate on a weekend. One of them I knew, so I was learning that. It's just by using your best answer to get people to let you in. Basically, you're with them. Yeah. So anything goes. Mm-hmm. They were friends. The guy in the red top was actually one of the friends of my friends.
Oh, thank you. And then, Adam, there was that one picture of that lad. I think he was next to some lad. It looked like he was in hospital or had a stomach wound or something.
Yeah.
What was the story behind that?
That was a guy that was in kind of the group that Viper was in from Loughborough Estate. But that was, he was stabbed, actually. I've got a really kind of powerful voice recording about that. That was mistaken identity. And that happened broad daylight on Camberwell Green, outside McDonald's. And the guy stabbed him and then went, oh shit, sorry, that. And the two guys that stabbed him actually called the ambulance and waited until the ambulance came with him. Which, I think says a lot about kind of the way these kids are thinking and how quickly they act sometimes or react. I can't portray it as well as the voice recording, of course, but it was a very sad case. But he was okay. That was about a week after, and he was discharged about 2 days after that.
And if you're taking pictures of, to try and tell this story, as a photographer, do you sometimes think you wish you were there at that moment when that happened?
I guess you could say that about a lot of situations, but I think initially, I think maybe 10 years ago, photographs of real violence would have maybe, I don't know, necessary in this picture, in this kind of project is maybe the wrong thing to say, but I think photographers would have certainly sought after a lot more graphic images to kind of portray the story. But now my belief is, with the kind of blitz media coverage of everything, that if you have any interest at all and you do any research, you know what's happening, you know people are getting stabbed, you don't have to spell it out for people, Hopefully with that picture you can see that something's happened that's led to that. And it's my belief you don't have to show that whole event in its entirety. But of course, there's some events, it would be nice to see as well, but I don't know.
Robin, what was your in?
What was my
in?
How did I get access?
Yes.
I went to I was photographing Hackney more in general, and I wanted to see that side of things. And on first, I got in touch with a press officer at Hackney Police, and he was kind of at the end of his time doing that. It was all very old school. And he said, well, I know a sergeant who's young and keen and might like to have you come along. So I got in touch with her, and we started a good relationship over a couple of years where they trusted me and I was in the briefs. So I was very lucky to meet one person. I actually spoke to press officers 2 or 3 years later, and they said, who are you and what have you been doing? I nearly put the phone down very quickly. sometimes you can't go through the normal channels, I guess.
Okay, next question. There's a question over there.
Can I ask Robert, where does the title come from?
Robin.
Hold
on, am I got your name wrong?
No, you're right.
I'm right. Yeah. So I'm getting paranoid here. It is. Anyway, we can ask Robert, but I think his name's Robin.
I had a meeting with Perpignan when it was half done with a photographer called Dennis Stock from Magnum. He'd taken a lot of famous, iconic pictures in the 60s. and he reviewed all people's portfolios, and he kept saying, crap, go back to college. And then I think, oh God, what's he going to say about my work? And he said, it's a good set of pictures, now finish it. And I said, well, I'm not sure it's a very good story to get. I don't know what I'm going to do with it. It's very difficult to publish this kind of thing in newspapers, etc. And he said, are you kidding? It's the biggest story going, our kids are going to hell. And he's 85 years old, so he's allowed to feel like that. But I suppose I used it rhetorically, really. I mean, it's a question. Maybe should have a question mark. Kind of tongue-in-cheek.
Next. I've got one. I was, a long time ago for The Observer, I did a piece about American neo-Nazis with a Magnum photographer called Len Fried. And for the purposes of this story, you've got to know that I'm a lapsed Catholic and Len is Jewish. And these people were neo-Nazis, and they had it was a long time ago, so they had an LP of Hitler's speeches and baseball bats with nails and pictures of Hitler and swastikas. And at the time, it was cold, snow on the ground. I had a big black coat, and I was had a hat, and I had a large beard. And suddenly, one of the neo-Nazis was a bit thick, said to me, he looks Jewish to me. And I had the most appalling urge to say, well, I'm not Jewish, but he is. So, the point of that, anyway, we got out, and Len, who's a great photographer, said, well, Jew boy, let's go for a drink. So my question is, this is difficult stuff. What about hassle?
I think I did. You were looking at me, so I assume you're
answering. I'm starting with you, yeah. And then I want answers from all three.
Well,
because all three sets of pictures, you've got intimate and personal moments.
Yeah. Mine's not particularly brave. It's sort of embedded, isn't it? But for me, it was the honest relationship with the subject matter, in a sense of distance and coldness and a sort of wide view. So in terms of hassle, sometimes I was in there a bit quick and there were still things going on, but it wasn't very dangerous. I didn't have a stab to a vest or anything. I mean, it's not really.
How does it play into actually living and working and continuing?
In Hackney? Yeah. I don't live there anymore. I changed my jacket a few times. But no, there was a couple of kids out on the street when I did a lot of work with the police on it, with the Vice stuff out on the street, and a couple of kids said, we'll see you around in it. I don't particularly worry too much about it. I mean, it was more saddening and depressing to be up at 6 a.m. and seeing that than it was frightening or exciting or dangerous for me. I didn't really want to get the danger or the action.
Jocelyn?
Well, again, talking to people, getting them to trust you, and genuinely giving them pictures afterwards and making sure they feel at ease, and that they're not being exploited. I think that's the key.
What about the posh kids? Because I would have thought
again,
that...
I mean, I got to know these guys. It was a Canadian bloke, actually, that I just met in Cambridge. Just got talking and said, come with us. So we ended up, but like being mates and took me off to the St. Edmunds ball and everything else, which, bless him, my lovely Swiss journalist I was working with couldn't actually get access to. So in the end, it was sort of over a few beers, talking to the students, getting to know friends. As you know yourself, as a journalist, you sort of spend time talking to people. And again, they got all the pictures. I sent everything to everybody. They all have, so far.
There was a couple who looked as though they were enjoying themselves.
Shagging show.
Yeah. But yeah. If I was either person's mum, I'd be a bit...
Well, their backs to the camera, you can't really recognise them. And the guy in the pink shirt jacket was one, he was with us. So he was actually part of the group I was with.
Right.
So I knew him.
Yes.
So again, there wasn't... I don't think that one was shown, actually. Of course, we got censored at City Hall. So I think that was one that didn't actually get on the walls because it was deemed too risque for the under fives, so you might see it at City Hall.
And that kind of thing doesn't happen in Scotland.
No.
How does that compare to the experience that you had with the firm?
Well, the firm took four years. It's all about trust, and they know me. They still know me. I still talk to them. I still photograph them.
it's strangely complicit. And there's that odd thing about keeping a distance with the firm that I can still show the truth. And they actually seem to be okay with that.
What is the firm, by the way? Simple question.
It's a project I did a few years ago on the underworld, on the British Mafia. So.
And that you don't show their faces?
Yeah, of course. But again, I spent a lot of time with them.
Right.
So they got to know me. That's the whole point. I think, from my point of view, taking photographs, it's all about the image, it's all about the person in the image. It's not about me, it's about the person I'm photographing. So that respect has to be there, and that trust has to be there. Otherwise, I can't be honest, and I can't be genuine about the pictures. So with the underworld, the gangsters, they know exactly who I am.
Do they know where you live?
Yes, they do. I was out with them on Sunday, because I'm thinking about doing an update on it, and it's weird going back to that dark side. And one of them actually said, no, don't ask him to pose. He'll tell you to fuck off. You're not allowed to pose because we know him. And it's bizarre. But that's what I think, you know, if you spend time, if you're genuine with people, you do get a response. It's different with under 17-year-olds in council estates because they have a different raison d'etre. But with the old guard, it's very, you know, it's not difficult. But again, time is everything. So 4 years, one would hope they do know who you are. Spending a week is slightly difficult.
Adam, Hassel?
I touched on a lot of what Jocelyn's just mentioned too. Robin's project was a lot different, but I mean, what you're talking about, Jocelyn, I mean, I think just going in with a really kind of honest set of reasons for taking the photographs, I mean, that for me, that's the most important thing. If somebody turns around and rightfully so says, you know, why are you here? If you can't answer them with one line that really, you know, makes sense to them, then you should really be questioning your own kind of... your own presence in their life, you know, because at the end of the day, you're taking from them. So there's a responsibility to kind of use that well. And if you haven't got in your head what you're going to use it for, then you need to go back to the drawing board. I mean, that's my opinion. But in terms of, I mean, like, I guess the media image, as much as I tried to fight against it in my head, did play up with me a few times when I was out. I mean, I spent a lot of time in the early hours in the streets around Brixton and really never got into any problems at all. You know, I had a friend of mine, Sam, who's here tonight. He was on speed dial, you know, he knew the code if something was going wrong, this is where I'm going to be. And just, I mean, but that's probably, you know, me being a little bit petrified in my own head, but this is how I dealt with it. But the kind of the scariest thing I came up against was actually with the police. I was in an estate called Myatt's Fields Estate in Brixton, and they'd been involved in a lot of kind of tit-for-tat activity with Peckham, and there'd been a shooting the previous week, so understandably there was a lot of undercover presence that I didn't really know about when I walked into it, but 5 minutes later did. I walked in with the kind of camera backpack on, and I was being brought in by a guy that does a lot of the YouTube videos for the gangs, for the groups, and he brought me in because, you know, as Jocelyn's been talking about, it's very important to have that contact who can vouch for you, who can say this guy's okay. And he brought me in and introduced me to two guys from this group, and we met in a stairwell, and they were just showing scars, you know, that he was, this guy that had the camera was doing a little bit of video footage for a project he was doing about the after effects of knife crime. And I was just starting my project. And so I was in the stairwell, and all of a sudden, you know, we heard this big alsatian, and I was very slow to react. By the time I realized what was happening, I was up against the wall, and there was kind of three undercover police had us up. And they just literally thought it was some sort of drug or arms dealing, because I walked in with a white guy, walked into this estate with a big black backpack, and meets
and an
with
Irish
two,
accent.
An Irish accent, yeah.
And exactly the wrong kind of Irish accent as well. I mean, there's none worse.
And I looked a lot scruffier. So, yeah, they were probably, you know, they probably thought they'd really hit the target. But, you know, when they started pulling out cameras and the recording equipment, they were a little bit confused. And one of them said to me, like, what are you doing here? I mean, they could not grasp at all how I could be there by myself, you know. And I just told them the same as I was telling people in the street, you know, this is a project I'm doing, and this guy, I know this guy, it's okay. And they left us alone. But that was probably the scariest moment in a lot of time in Brixton, so I don't know if that answers any questions or not, but maybe.
So, what's your accent? Next question.
Right to left.
Right, yeah. All three of you. Damn good question.
I suppose you're supposed to think small and work big. I be very particular about what you're doing, but it didn't work out that way for me. I had all kinds of pictures. I had people just been stabbed, going into ambulances, all kinds of things, black and white. and it was confusing, you know, to make sense of it all. And I think we just, when you start to edit the pictures, you're boiling it down to make a stronger argument or a clearer picture of what you're trying to say. That was my experience with how I edited it, and it made sense what aspect of the police and the kids and the environment that I want to show by the end. Over time, just re-editing and re-editing. So I think there was some clear choices about what was documentary and what was too documentary for me, what was too obvious, and also what was sort of strangely almost like a negative El Decor of people's interiors. I'd try and get away from that. So they're the two things I was trying not to do.
Even if it was an amazing picture?
No, if it's an amazing picture, it's definitely in for me. Yeah, it's the borderline ones.
Yeah, for me it's more about the kind of subject. So each portrait, those portraits were key characters who all said what they had to say. So doing little stories that in each different situation, so Zante, Cambridge, Carnival, Brixton, Exeter, putting the whole thing together as a whole. So yeah, it was a bit of a struggle, because I mean, you know, actually a friend helped me, I've got to be honest. And she kind of drowned the puppies that didn't really work, and it became quite a nice essay after that.
I think for me, each project that I've done has been different. I think a lot I do call upon friends as well, because it's a lot on your head, and it's hard to kind of remove your emotions from a lot of pictures when you've been there and seen what's happened to lead to that picture, and you really want to hold on to it. But actually, to somebody who's never seen it, it doesn't say anything. So it's helpful to have somebody kind of on the outside give you a bit of a shake or drawing the puppies, as Jocelyn. But for this project, it was a little bit different. It was because with the guy, Jean-Claude Viper, that I worked with, he, you know, it was really him. And it was kind of the journey, the narrative was spelled out by him through the words and through the pictures he chose. And he was happy to leave the kind of cliched images at the start, which represented him and some other people from around Brixton, because it kind of formed the narrative for his life and his transition from that being in that circle to kind of focusing on music, which is what he's doing now. So I was lucky to have that, you know, to have somebody who was like as emotionally committed to the project as me, who was, you know, knew a lot more about it than me, right by my side, kind of helping me out.
There's a point at the back.
Do you think that closeness of the subject to helping you do kind of narrative and editing, do you think that takes away from, I don't know, an authenticity of the project, or do you think it has like an ethical challenge to it?
Yeah, quite possibly. I mean, but I never, like, from the start, the project wasn't, it wasn't me doing it. It had to be a collaboration. So I look upon the work as not just, I couldn't have produced that by myself, so I'm happy to share that authorship with him. It's as much him as it is me, and that's why this works for me anyway, because I can't write captions about what he's feeling when he's visiting his friend in hospital. I could, but I wouldn't feel comfortable doing it. So I don't know what the ethics are there or not, but yeah, for this, certainly for this project, it's as much his authorship as me. I'm happy to sacrifice that, you know, because at the end he gave it all to me, so I couldn't have done it without him, so.
There's a question there, and then there's a question over there in the middle.
Do you think as men it gives you a different perspective on this subject matter?
As a man?
Yeah, all three of you.
Difficult to say, because
Have you thought of having a sex change and then...
I wear a kilt sometimes.
Stumped.
Just set up. I don't know. I don't even think there's a sexual component in it, really.
A gender component.
There's a white guy as well.
Of course.
That's
a white guy's different.
That's more,
of course. Yeah. I mean, yes. That's the question we want to hear from people in the audience. You know, how can we as photographers, in any form, go into that world and come out with something credible? Or
I'm just slightly questioning your motivation, because it seems like, you know, Jocelyn, great work, but you seem to be drawn to this particular type of area, and I'm just interested to know
Cambridge University.
What was your motivation?
Actually, it was an assignment. So it started an assignment and became, you know, got quite passionate about it. Yeah. And spent 6 months, in fact, I should only spend a month. So it intrigued me, and especially as Adam said, you know, the talk of teenage gangs trying to look under the surface of why this is happening in our country. And again, you know, Dennis Stock, this is the most important issue that's happening in the Western world right now, youth. and that's why we're here. Mm. And this is why tabloids are screaming about it. Everybody wants those pictures of knife and gun crime. Well, let's try and look a bit deeper. Male, female, black or white. It affects all of us. I don't have kids yet. I'd like to have them one day. And I live in the UK, so I want to look at what's going on in my society. So, yeah, that interests me.
Definitely. I think it's a wider question about happiness as well. And, and you know, it's not just about money and opportunity in these places. There's a kind of, they're all part of a high capitalist thing. There's a lot of stuff in these houses, but the happiness question about high capitalism, meaning and identity, goes from the bottom right up. And I think, you know, we look at these places as really particular, but there is a big question about the meaning in life and stuff, how you get your stuff, how you get your likes, and what it all means. That was my starting point about sharing a space with people. You know. As a wider group of people, not for me, it wasn't about individuals in the same way for these guys. Some of my projects would be a lot more personal, but I really want to look at the space and the atmosphere.
There was a question in the middle there, yes, that lady, and then yeah. Are you the new big brother?
No, I feel like a lot of my intention for doing this work in this way is almost anti-surveillance in the traditional sense. It's a question of, for me, there's a lot of spaces. The big question about my work is what are you doing in someone's house? And, of course, that remains a decision. And I feel there's a lot of danger with photography at the moment for photographers. And for society in general, who makes the pictures, who's allowed to make pictures, and the public-private spaces. So, you know, I'm big on that subject, really, in terms of you can't shoot in a shopping mall anymore, you can't shoot in a supermarket anymore. So there's a lot of questions about if it goes the same way as it's going in France, about not being able to photograph people in the street. Like Ian Berry said, who's making the record of society? And you've got to be brave and say, I've got a perspective and I'm going to do it. Otherwise, you end up with just very safe, dry, big format landscapes. That's my personal feeling, you know. I think photography is always both. It's always a journey of discovery. If you pretend it's not, then it's one of the problems that journalism is coming to at the moment, I think, which is it's not evolved to accept that it's not a black and white account of what's going on. And that's what a lot of documentary photographers are trying to get their heads around. And it is complicated, and there are ethical questions about it. But I think, you know, we've got to... if you're not... You've got to make decisions, and you can't not work. You've got to be brave about it, I think, no matter what the I said, you know, the way I looked at my work was that I know that I'm not here just to have a look, to get up at 6 in the morning to see what's going on. You know, I'm not here to record what a great job the police are doing. I'm not here because I'm interested in looking at people in a bad situation. You know, that might not be a good enough defence, but... You know, I felt like I was in too deep to let these moral questions stop me from telling a story, and a story which I felt quite strongly about. So.
There's a question there. I was just wondering, would it be possible to spin through all three as we're talking, so that there are images which I saw very quickly, and I thought, stuff. Anyway, there's a question from the lady there.
You have one shot and you see the images, and it was a guy who's just been arrested. He's sitting on a sofa and he coughs. It's quite a wonderful moment to have a veteran and be arrested.
Yeah, I think definitely. You just can't. You'd never get anything done if you work on modern release. I think that's the worry about the way. I know it's a difficult picture, and actually, my editor was, my publisher was obsessed with that picture, and it wasn't initially in there. I know the one you mean, and it is one of those ones that's very close on. You can see who it is. They're in their house, but no, you just. I mean, there was an idea to go back, I've taken this position, I've got to go with it. I can't go back and pretend that I'm working backwards and that I was here 2 weeks ago photographing you getting busted. How do you feel about it? Can we follow up the work? Maybe, but you know, this wasn't the project I was doing. I tend to think, and it may be arrogant to think, but I tend to think that worse things are happening in their day than me taking that picture. And that may, you know, it's a very small scale book. There's a disclaimer at the front of it. I'm definitely not making any money out of it. You know, so there's a few things that if it was a monster book and I was making a fortune. Yeah.
I understand.
That's a motorbike.
I understand where you're coming from, but I think, I'm not going to speak for you, Robin, but I think, you know, at that stage you go back and you look at your kind of reasons for the whole project, and if that's adding to it and your ideas are sound and ethically sound, you know, sometimes there are always going to be kind of those pictures with R. If you stick them up just by themselves, maybe, yeah, it's kind of questionable, but within a wider body of work that has a purpose, then.
And exactly as Robin said, the Douane Dimanche thing in Paris, I mean, in France, you know, if we have that here, then there's going to be no future. We're not going to be able to see what's going on. If we are journalists or photographers, then we need to report what's going on with our own intentions, with our own, I hope, right-headed intentions, but to tell the truth of a situation.
Or your truth. Certainly this book, my book, is never claimed to have any journalistic integrity. These guys have probably got in their relationships. It's a much more broader, almost fictional, emotive account of the place I live, you know. So
did you find out that guy's story that
you was like? No, I mean, from the start, if I was interested in individual stories, I would have probably followed one person, which is the traditional documentary approach to this kind of thing. And it's just, for me, this was about surfaces and appearances and atmospheres. And it wasn't, I got all the stories, I know what most of these people have done before we went on the drugs raid. So obviously you're already, your sympathy is not with the police, and it's certainly not with the people being busted a lot of the time. But of course that position, you have to get a general feeling of empathy for what's causing these situations, the environment, the typical purposeless war on drugs. There's bigger questions for me than the individual stories in this project. And I hope if you look at the whole edit of the book, you get a sense of that. And yeah, photography, you can end up using people as empty ciphers that you project onto. And you can only judge whether that's been worthwhile and successful in a project like that by people's reaction afterwards, I suppose. And not everyone's going to agree with it.
I'm just thinking as a reporter, the difficulty is if you ask everybody's permission every time you take a photograph or start your rolling your camera, you won't get it. I haven't actually worked in France for ages. So what's the story from France?
Droit de l'image. It basically means that everyone has the right to their own image. So if you take a photograph in the street, if you publish that picture in a magazine or certainly advertising, you will be sued. Because that person can recognise that's their image and they have a right to own their own picture.
And how much money?
It's been going for 10 years now. Up to about 30,000 euros. Got to the point where the French, of course, were flooded with it. But nonetheless, this is why you don't see pictures of France at home anymore. Unless it's, you know, 5-4 still life, complicit images. Yeah.
You could be a tiny person on a beach in an ad campaign. Yeah. They could sue your ass. It's worrying.
In California, slightly different thing, but what's happened is the Californian state has issued a privacy law, which means, this was an issue for us when we tried to do a film about Scientology. There were a number of issues about that film. But one of the things was that celebrities all gave us interviews, and then they decided not to sign the piece of paper they would. And then they said, no, you have no right to use the interviews that they had given to us. And had we shown what they said, they would have sued us in California, and the BBC could have spent $3-4 million on winning the case, which we would have done, but we would not have got our money back. And that is, in Pine in California, the power of celebrities and rich people to say, we control the image. So the problem is, yes, some of these images seem very personal. At the same time, the opposite. You're going towards a kind of rich man's North Korea. But that's how I, as a completely unbiased chairman, think. Chap with his hand up, and then the next two around.
Just, Robin, really, were the police involved in the editing of the book and did they censor any of the images?
We're
thinking the answer's no.
No, the answer's no, yeah. I did show the head of Hackney Police, because I was trying to get more access through the press woman right at the end, and she said, oh, I think Steve Dan's available now. I thought, oh, no, I've got to take the whole box of prints up and show the total boss of Hackney Police. And he went through them and said, oh, it seems like a fairly fair reflection. So at that point, I thought, probably done a pretty crap job. But I was amazed that at least it's important for me that he recognised what I'd done was a fair reflection on what they deal with. And I thought, I didn't show him Cock on the Notepad and a couple of others, but it was important for me, as it would be important for someone who'd been raided. I can't show them the pictures, but I can hope that a wide group of people recognise what's done. I sent JPEGs into the police after every raid and said they had the chance to veto pictures, but it was only going to that sergeant who was really useful and helpful. So it never happened. That I offer that possibility that people can edit the pictures and veto things to get more access, and pray it never happens.
Gentlemen there.
Something wrong. It seems like she was any sort of contempt. Did you have to wait till the case was over, and if they were not guilty, could you never use them?
Yeah, I don't know about that. I think most of these kids are out on bail that next night. You know, I think it's really complicated. Legal proceedings, and that's sort of the pointlessness of the whole war on drugs thing. You know, they sit there in silence and they know that a lot of the time the evidence hasn't been found. So often it was just leaving the door hanging off and saying sorry. You know, we'll be back next week.
There's lady there, and then the yes, you first.
I'm not involved in this one.
Well, portrait is a portrait. You're talking someone face to face. But then there's also the situation. So I always, it's a different thing. Portrait is a portrait. And sometimes I like people looking straight at the camera, especially this project, because it's a sort of a linchpin to hang all the different stories on, those faces that, the words are attached to.
And you tend to make suggestions about where they stand?
Not really, no. I don't say much. I don't like directing too much. Not with documentary. Fine, it's documentary, but no, it has to just be. You use your composition, your eye, to frame an image, and obviously catch the moment. I just thought, when someone's talking or looking at it, it's pretty straightforward. Just click, 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 and I hope they're looking at the camera, and they're not saying, look at me.
You wouldn't get someone to move to make a perfect.
No, I
usually just move yourself.
Yeah, no, yes, I agree with a lot of what Justin's saying. I mean, there can be times when you're taking a formal portrait, and then if you hang around 3 hours later, the guy will forget you're there and become bored of you, and then relax into the kind of mood that you wish you'd walked into the first stage. I mean, for me, I think that's fine ethically. I think that's okay, because if you've been there long enough to witness what he's actually doing, and if he's fallen back into that mode and you haven't told him to do it, I think that's okay. But yeah, for documentary work, not with the orchestrating, but because you're not trying to portray it as the truth, but you're trying to at least try and capture a reasonable amount of reality with it. So if you start telling them what to do, and 5 minutes before you weren't there telling them what to do, then that becomes, I think, a bit of a challenge.
It's the fun of it, too, to kind of catch the moment and find it. It's a challenge, aren't
it? My other question was, you were all shooting a lot in low light. Did you use tripods at all? How did you handle the technical difficulties of shooting in low light?
Digital for me.
I haven't used a tripod. I don't have a tripod. Just hold it it's still. But I use flashlight bulbs. Again, I don't want people to kind of look on there. 6'4", it's hard to hide anyway. So yeah. It's a flashlight.
I push film a lot. This project was shot a lot on slide film because I'm suicidal. But now I shoot, digital, high-end digital cameras. Now you can shoot up to 3200 very easily, and it's great. The grain's great. But yeah, with that, shooting down to 30th, the 15th, handheld, hold your breath, lock your arms in.
Yeah, because
nightmare.
Could I suggest we bring it back to gangs for a moment, just because I don't know if we've really talked about what we think about it.
There's a lady with a question, a gangs question.
We're talking about photography,
but I also remember there's a lady there who wants to talk. But first, you.
I wouldn't sit up here and comment on the state of youth today. I couldn't do it. I mean, I can say about a guy that I've become very friendly with, who I think his life is going in a positive way, or certainly a more positive direction than when I met him. I don't think he's arrived. He should have been here tonight. What he was doing tonight, he started doing voluntary work at the Milton Music Studio I met him in. And they were organising tonight for local police officers in Brixton to come in. And his job was to go into the estates around Brixton and bring at least sort of 60 young kids in to try and start some sort of rapport with police. That's not an easy thing to do for a start, but that's a massive change in the first time I met him, because he would have been one of the kids running away from the guy saying, come and meet the police. And now he's trying to initiate this. And he's obviously got reasons for that. And I think they're good reasons. So, you know, I can't comment on the state of all the kids out there, but at least for this one experience, I think, you know, he's doing good things, so hopefully he will show up and you guys can have a chat with him.
Yeah, I feel much the same as that. I'm not a sociologist, I'm not a youth worker, I'm a photographer, so I can tell you the kids I spoke to and what they think. But the state of British youth, and everyone does have their own opinion. The overriding thing I got was it's pretty negative. Most of the people I photographed were from Harrow or from Brixton. They weren't particularly happy about being here. A lot of it is basic stuff, you know. No youth centres, no boxing clubs, no football clubs, nothing. No support, no community. The same old stuff that we read about, but coming from the other 20-year-olds. They're the ones we should be talking about, not me.
Can I just add on the end of that, though? The beginning of showing all the pictures, a lot of the kind of instigation for your project was to find out about British youth. And towards the end, obviously, you know, you've been the authors of your own projects, you've produced your own books. Jocelyn perhaps is slightly separate because you've had an editor commission you and choose their pictures. So perhaps you let go of a bit of control there.
Well, I chose the pictures that actually if it came.
Yeah,
definitely.
But why does that kind of concern with you end when it kind of throws its hands up and saying, I'm not going to be the one to determine what it is?
No,
an ongoing interest.
Definitely, I think so.
Yeah. Well, can I just say, certainly with the thing I did with Sky, like I said in the beginning, it's all voice as well as pictures. So they are saying in their own words how they feel on every image. It's all with quotations, all recorded. And that's as much work as taking the pictures. That's why I'm saying I'm not the one who should be regurgitating what they said. This should be, you know, it's a sort of audiovisual, really, with their own voices. There was a sense of really looking at and listening to what British youth had to say. And that was what made this important, certainly as a web story, because their voices are on the web as well. So you can hear what they have to say.
There's a question there.
Yeah, do you think your series works without the voices?
Well, I think certain images it does. I mean, certainly the purpose was to have the words too.
Okay, so it's meant to be sort of an overview of British.
Yeah, I mean, overview, yeah, to build a bigger picture. So taking the intimate groups and sort of looking at it as disparate as possible.
Do you feel that you've got more work to do?
Oh, definitely. Absolutely. That's the last bit. That's the start. Oh, yeah, I'm continuing with this.
Jocelyn, of the groups that you did, who was the most fun to take photographs of?
I think the kids in Guruk. They were great.
Did you understand them?
Yeah. They're just good fun.
Sorry, that's a triple anti-Scottish joke, for which I apologise.
I'm half Scots anyway.
Why were they the most fun?
I think because they had a very positive vibe about them. And they were just a good, dark Scottish sense of humour. I respond to that. It's completely personal.
Did you think that they were, because they're all roughly the same age, did you think that they were really different?
Yeah, I think they were. I mean, maybe it's because in Gourock and Port Glasgow they've grown up expecting less. And there's a strong sense of humour, a very black sense of humour from that part of Scotland. Kind of people, I don't know, they just seem to have that life about them that the kids in South London perhaps don't possess. Circumstance, situation. I think Gourock as well is a tighter community, so well, such as it is, but they've all grown up in the same area, it's smaller. I won't say it's a community because, again, that's the place where the community centre was burnt down. And they're the kids that have been moved on by the police every week. And they're only 15-year-olds. They're like ordinary, normal British kids who are facing this sort of police state, in a way, with nowhere to go. But I did sense that there's a strong Scottishness about them that gives them something different, I think.
Is that possibly... A strong identity that we may be questioned is a problem in the South London housing estates and stuff about kids knowing what they're all about, knowing, being proud of where they're from, being proud of what they're all about, and that's kind of what,
rather than making their own society, there's something that's built perhaps in Gourock and Port Glasgow that you don't find in the South. I need to explore more. I honestly don't know. I
felt there's a bit of confusion in the kids that are being raided in their homes for drugs. I mean, on one level, the hip hop culture that they prescribe to is produced on Saturday mornings on TV. It's all part of mainstream culture. And on the next level, when they lead out the lives and they live those lives, they've got 20 policemen in their bedroom. So it's that kind of double-edged shock that is part of the identity confusion for me. And I wondered if just bring in a guy I met this week called David Jay, who's a poet. David? If we're not eloquent with words, he's supposed to be. He's told me he is anyway. I haven't heard any of it. But he's definitely got something to say with words about, because he's worked with kids in gangs and youth and tried to bring what he does into their lives a bit. So I don't know. You don't need a mic, do you, Dave? Do you want to come up and use a mic?
I need a mic. So I'll be unleashing myself in your dome right now. What I find, basically, I wouldn't say I work intensively with gangs or whatever, but because we're involved in word, prayer, poetry, I've been on a journey where we connect with people through their interests. I'm not going to try and stand up here and pretend to be like a professional. I've got this solution or whatever. I understand that most things come from a point where it's honor based, and you do many things to basically protect your honor. And the only thing is, when we actually don't work with wordplay, we connect with people who have the same interests. And then we try and groom through their writing. When we did work with youth offenders, we found that we was in a small room, I can't say the place, and we were just to get their words together, what they're interested in, what their environment is. And we found that what they were doing was confessing and glorifying their crimes within their poetry. And you couldn't say, oh, that's an excellent verse. You're feeling the poetry, but then you're also like, oh, you're confessing what you've done and what you haven't actually been caught for. And you've actually got key workers there sitting, taking notes, because many people, when they're expressing something, they release more than they would actually get in the court situation. And what a lot of key workers are finding is that most of the youth that they're actually trying to groom out of the camps are actually reading most of the literature. So basically, the key worker hasn't got a chance, because sometimes they're reading everything and they know what angle they're taking. And they're like, you know what, I'll come in here for free. Then, as we're doing the poetry, getting them in, they're getting excited, they're getting phone calls, basically, because their parent or the person they answer to is calling them, so they actually leave the class and have to do various things, and some of them actually apologise and say they liked the workshop and it was a bit too late for them, and they leave, and that's sad. Sometimes I agree with some of them, but what I'd say is basically we give a voice to things and we try and connect with them through their music. So you'll find that most of them are actually born without a heart. Their light is in the dark. The drugs aren't actually broken on the planes. Born without a heart, their light is in the dark. Their satellites that monitor all weaponry that is brought into various countries. So how do guns actually reach the community and distribute? They actually don't have any serial numbers. Born without a heart, their light is in the dark. Their hands on the cross. If you look inside the book, Maddox actually does. you can actually see images inside their bedroom of things that actually connected to them. You can see Tupac and people that actually they've looked up to, because some of them haven't got the images and role models that they really need to connect with. So they look in many places where they can see something manly that they can actually connect to. And then they incorporate that lifestyle into their vocabulary, and then they project it into their community. There is a picture in one of the books about, by any means necessary, a picture of Malcolm X. Very symbolic that you can actually see the symbol of Malcolm X, whose famous phrase was, by any means necessary. And they actually take that phrase and they use that to get things monetary. Maybe they're actually copying capitalist people that they also see going after things for monetary gain. So it is important with poetry to put your life inside of a phrase. And you caught the moment, as you burst in with the camera, when the phone was actually ringing and you saw the name LB. So I'm thinking lyrically and spiritually, what was actually going through your mind when I asked you, when you actually take the picture and you capture something that actually lasts forever in time. And you can see the story through an image that these photographers tell when they project everything into their mind's eye. And they use their time to bring you those images that actually speak. So even without the voice attached to the image, you can actually see the journey of what actually goes on. And you will find that people are born with a heart, their lives in the dark, their hand is on the chrome. They pull the trigger slow, you could be next. Life is a game of death, just staying alive is the ultimate test. Some of them grow up in the streets, known for deceit, deception, driving, stolen transportation, drug addiction. Plus the alteration of official documents, government benefits, false passports, smuggling, all sorts of packages through customs, airport security, couldn't see. Murder weapons cleverly concealed in the trench coats made of Italian leather. They stretch the black collar workers and the white collar workers, and the whole social class structure is manipulated by their demonically orientated thought pattern stimulating messages worse than previous bodily harm. They just pass the fingers and keep the trigger itchy. Somebody's the founder of car trucks and motorways. Alibis are arranged prior to the killing. This villain is actually merciless without feeling. Sometimes their dad is a cocaine, sniffing, womanizing, gambling, alcoholic. This certified schizophrenic is married to a woman at a trip in the park, and that's why you find it so. A woman without a heart, And my job is actually to connect. And when you rushed in with the police, there's places and under the floorboards you never find me. Because my name is not David J. My real name is Etroxinol Coca. I'm a mind altering nerve stimulator. I've stimulated the nerves and the gastrics of Amazonian warriors through the Mekong. I'm not therapeutic. My killing ratio is infinite. I leave you impotent in a schizophrenic state, hearing hypnotic suicidal voices. Your psychological dependence forces you to increase the dosage milligrams beyond human intolerance. Every subservient mind addict welcomes death with no resistance. You're gambling your life away. You're going to lose it. Your health is detrimented and neglected when you irresponsibly persisting altering your body chemistry for you. Forehead brushes. The government know my name, and they know that I can leave you lifeless, stiff and cold. My name is Coffin. But I give you two choices. The coffin casket or the rehabilitation clinic. Enjoy every moment of your life when you're here and keep breathing. Keep breathing for those that have lost theirs. Some say many people are born without a heart and their light is in the dark, but many people don't actually realize that they need to be brought back and redirected and just directed and basically connect with something that they actually love. And you connect with people with actually what they love when you talk to them in a room and you talk about their talents and you don't make them glorify what they shouldn't be doing. They're looking at role models that they shouldn't actually be looking at. And they actually worship the spirit of metal. And that's why you find them killing each other. Killing each other for honor, for monetary gain, because they don't have anything to actually live up to. So what we do is connect with them and we tell them what you can actually do with the inner energy inside your body and your soul. And the inner energy inside the frontal lobe that connects with the diametral tryptamine that secretes in the pineal gland and actually develops features inside your mind. Just like these people who develop features inside your mind by myself. One love, one life.
Very good. Pictures inside your mind. I see Viper has arrived, yes? Would you like to come and sit here? I'll sit there. Because you can tell everybody here what you think, what it's like to have your life invaded by a photographer. Indeed, one from Northern Ireland. So have you got a mic? Can you give Viper a mic? Smashing. Is your name Jean-Claude?
Yeah.
Smashing. What's it... You've seen the pictures that Adam Patterson took.
Yeah.
What was that experience like? Why did you let him? Why did you let this mad Irishman take your pictures of your life?
Well, it's because I want everybody to see what pain we go through, not just me, but the other black youths in Lambeth or around London. Because what the media don't understand is we go through a lot of things. See? So I chose that, and Adam had a project to do, and I went through it, so I want to show the people out there my pain and my stress and how we live, where we're from.
Why did you trust him?
Because I trust everybody in this room. I trust everybody. So.
That's not what you said at the start, though. What? Tell the truth.
Did some of your friends say, why is this guy taking pictures of us?
Yeah, a lot of my friends.
How did you deal with that?
How did I deal with that? I'm like, nothing. I said, Ra is a nice person and he's here to help us, not just me. Because if he's helping me, he's helping you lot as well, because my story is going out there so they can hear our cry and help us. So I dealt with Ra. If Adam is helping me, you lot should appreciate it. So, you know, first, they actually thought he was gay. That's it.
Okay.
De la Vap, why are you walking with this bat, man? He's not a bat, man. You know.
So is the audience. Those are my questions. We've got one of the people actually inside the pictures. So has anybody got a question for?
Yeah. I think the pictures and the book actually changed my life. Can't you see? I just came back from work from Call 7 and it just changed my life. Now, everywhere I go, I get a lot of help. I feel proud of the pictures. I love the pictures. I look at it every day. And that's me. It's not fake. It's real. So I love it. You're welcome. Yeah, a lot of them. Because I got a couple of friends that got scars, but they never came too early for Adam to take pictures of them. But we do in the next one. Hopefully they will be in there.
But do they see also how the pictures, you know, like...
They love the pictures. Yeah.
You know, they would like that opportunity as well.
Yeah, a lot of them. Now I'm working with youth. They want to do that as well. So, you know.
Do you find when Adam was taking the pictures, your mates were like extremely skeptical, and then maybe before he actually started taking the pictures, you might have had a slight skepticism about it. But then when your mates saw the pictures, was it an evident change of like, oh shit, actually that guy's pretty sick taking pictures, and like,
yeah,
the pictures are good?
No, not even that. It's not just first time, yeah. Adam took a picture of me. And he brought it back to me, and I showed it to the people. Everyone said, "Wow, the pictures look sick." Yeah, Adam is doing it, and from there I decided to work with him. If it was rubbish, then I would have said, "Move." I would have said, "Move." It was very good. Then, do you know what got me shocked? The picture I loved the most is the one with my hand. I never took a picture like that. I really love that picture. I even got it in my office, everywhere in my workplace. Nah, because he never told me to take down my trousers or my clothes, so you know. I'm like, all right, we can work.
can I ask if it makes you feel like you want to take pictures as well? I mean, is he gave you a camera for?
Yeah, I took a couple pictures.
Yeah,
and I feel like I want to take pictures every day.
Yeah,
even though it's not my thing, but I'm trying to learn that.
Yeah,
he brought me to some woman to, what's it called again?
Photo Fusion's doing some workshops, and Sean Claude's going to be taking part in one in January.
Yeah,
doing exactly that, Robin. Yeah,
because that's exactly it. I mean, it should be you guys taking the pictures, not us.
You lot getting too old now. It's our time.
And it is because of the digital cameras. You can get them straight online and do whatever you want.
Yeah, that's what I want to do. I want to pull it on Facebook.
It's fantastic.
Take pictures and pull on. Yeah.
Is there at all a sense that obviously Adam wants to came to do this story because of what he thought was a gang, you know, kind of crime story, and to get to the bottom? Is there a sense from your part that, you know, that almost brings a certain notoriety and fame to you in that story? That's the right way.
Yeah, that was the right way, because first there wasn't camera around, video camera. That's our video camera or pictures, so there wasn't video camera around and video around. So I rather take pictures and, you know, write my own story. I feel like doing my own story right now. I told Adam we need to write another book.
Are you not too nice now, though?
Adam,
are you not too nice now? The story disappeared. In terms of what he went to find, in terms of, you know, the danger on the, you know, we all go out there looking for, you know, something. It's always a journey to find something that's different to you, you know.
Yeah.
Different to yourself. You know, you can find that in your backyard, you know. So in some ways, I don't know where I'm going with this.
I know. I'm lost as well.
I guess I've never photographed myself. You know, it's a strange thing to do, isn't it? I've photographed my own life. I'm always trying to, you know, look at what's outside me. It's really hard to photograph yourself.
Yeah.
Avenues to publish this to, you know, large mass media that would change things is not necessarily there. That actually these stories are actually best suited to the people in the stories. That's perhaps the best use of the story.
I think there's certainly a fear about publishing. I mean, as I say, when we had the thing with Sky News last year, all this big fuss about putting on a web story, what have you, it was buried. You could hardly even find it. And worse still, when the exhibition at the City Hall, the mayor's office censored a lot of it, censored the words, tried to change the words, and I had to fight tooth and claw to keep the right words. I think there was one quotation from Guruk where one of the kids said, "It's shite up here." And that's the only thing I changed, and we changed it to shit. But actually, we had to lose about 5 pictures. That exhibition was going to go ahead, and it was necessary that it did, because it meant it was kind of opening to the public in London. Then I was faced with this, right, it will be censored. Those 4 images come out because they're too, you know, hardcore for the mayor's office to cope with. And yet, that was only 10 days. Not one magazine in this country ran that story. Not one. And it went to everywhere. 7, my agency pushed it everywhere. It wasn't sold once.
Same problem.
Yes,
the
same question. How much stuff this work has been sold?
I've had plenty of reviews, but I feel like I'm preaching to the already converted. You know, it's a photography community thing, a first book.
Yeah.
You're really nothing. I know all the picture editors from bloody photo festivals, and they're great at partying, but, you know, turn up with a story like that, and it's just not what they want to see in their Sunday magazines anymore. And it's going to kill magazines and newspapers in general, because they're taking the lowest denominator. They're not touching anything that's dodgy or risky or true. No, because
Adam, did you have any success in placing your work in commercial?
Absolutely not. It's not finished, but aggressively rejected everywhere. I mean, people just don't write back. I mean, you go into
an actual reason that did they say why they were rejected?
They don't really have to. You just have to look at what they're actually publishing, and then you'll work out why.
I have one reaction why it wasn't going to be published. It was because somebody else had taken a picture of a hen night in Belfast. No names mentioned, but very famous photographer. It was, you know, it cost a fortune for a certain Saturday magazine to run a story like. So that's why they wouldn't run the British Shoot Project.
The other cynical thing about all of this is, of course, that as soon as the story is out of the headline, which it is
exactly.
Now, because the murder rates in these areas have gone down considerably, that's why everybody says, well, why should we publish? It's not an issue anymore.
Exactly.
And it brings us back to the whole celebrity obsession, because if it's not Ben Kinsella who gets killed, who cares?
Well, that's right.
The
story I shot came out in October last year, and of course Obama's election to the press. Everything. There was nothing else worldwide. So,
I mean, I started this project, I guess, so I'm a bit of a hypocrite, because I started because of what they weren't looking at and then tried to sell it back to them. So I don't know, but of course, I mean, you'd love to get it out to a wider audience. That's the goal. And I do feel, you know, I feel bad when, you know, there's a great magazine here, Photoway, put it into it, and that's fantastic, but there's not many people in the area where I was taking the pictures that read Photoway magazine. So it does cloud you a little bit, and you know, I think then it becomes really important that the project is important to you and that you have really good reasons for doing it. And then at least at the end of it, you've got something that you have done for reasons of your, in yourself, even if you haven't been able to kind of break through that.
That's what I find publishing about your project is it's about the process, and it's a sort of redemptive process, and, you know, enriched your life, it seems, in a really
Absolutely.
Amazing way.
Yeah, no, totally. I mean, I think I started taking photo projects because I wanted to find out more about myself, and that's very selfish in some respects. So then I had to start stripping back that selfishness and find reasons for taking them, and then hopefully that led me into this, I guess. So.
There's a question here.
Sorry, you talk about kind of reasons and responsibilities to your subjects. Do you find that they shift throughout the process of the project? Like, because obviously you go in with a kind of concrete idea of what you want, and I mean, obviously they kind of change, but then when you kind of, you know, when the kind of responsibilities and the reasons why you're doing that with the project in the first place kind of shift, do you then question the whole project, or how does that, I mean, I guess I'm talking about ethics.
I think for me, when I'm in the middle of a project, I always think I might be mad and nothing's ever going to happen with it. You know, I don't know. Most photographers feel like that, I think. Because you can't see the light at the end of the tunnel. And you're always going back over and questioning yourself. That's part of it. I think if you found what you set out to find, it would probably be crap. Really boring. That's for me.
I find that it's quite organic. You sort of just keep going. You don't know where it's going to end. You know where it's going to lead. As long as you feel you're kind of doing something with integrity and it's interesting and means something to you, and perhaps then there's a wider audience for it. With the youth stuff, I'm not going to stop doing it just because no magazine wants to publish it at the moment. I'm sure Adam feels the same.
Yeah.
You know, things change. Nothing stays the same.
Yeah.
Okay, our industry's in crisis as photojournalists, but there are other ways to get it out there, and it's made a difference to Adam. So, I mean, come on. All this is good to push forward with.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the same. It's continually adapting. You have to. I mean, as Robin says, if you ended up with what you started off with, it probably wouldn't be anything, because you don't know. I mean, essentially, you don't know that much before you go in, so it should adapt with your knowledge, I think. But yeah, I mean, it's important that you do keep kind of keep hold of the reasons why you went into it, and hopefully maybe carry some of those kind of strong ethical points through it.
But there's also a sense that you shouldn't go in with a preconception, because you actually don't know, because it's not your world you're walking into. I mean, I'm in my 40s, for God's sake. What do I know about 17-year-olds? So I want to learn. If I keep an open mind, then I will. And an open eye, more to the point. I can't predict what I'm going to photograph. I want to see what happens next.
You know, I think from looking at Adam's work, from what I've seen in eight, he's definitely going to have a book of this work. You know, so that's the form that we're all documentary photographers are working towards, the perfect form. You're in control of it. It may reach a small audience, but it's out there and it's not going anywhere unless anyone starts burning books. You know, they're around. They exist as a document to over time, you know, of what we're seeing. So, and it's great for you know, our personal careers to have done that thing. So we're not, even though we know that magazines are not publishing this stuff, it doesn't stop. In fact, it just forces you to evolve and to find a new format, whether it's online or books or exhibitions.
I think belligerence as well, about the whole wedding marriage in France. You know, if we don't photograph that which is happening in our own country, sooner or later it might be banned. We actually have a bit of a duty to continue doing this.
It's getting close to 8:30. Let's do a couple more questions, and then we can go there. There's a question there, there's a question there, and a question there. So you first.
Yeah, I work with youth now.
What I want to know is, you said that Adam taking the photographs of you and doing the project had changed your life. Can you explain in what way, and are you going to be able to communicate that to the youth that you're working with and do the same thing for them?
How did it change my life? And basically, like the pictures that Adam took, and when I look back at what I used to do, I don't want to do that now. And now I work with youth, and I don't want them to go the same way that I went. I mean, or if they got pain in their chest, they can tell me, and we can do something about it. And now, I never thought I could help youth. I never knew I could do what Adam did now with the book. Look at me now. Like, I feel like I'm a businessman. I was supposed to be a rapper, but now I'm into pictures. So...
Someone was paying you their full attention, really focusing on you and hearing you and seeing you, is that what made the difference?
Yeah, probably because he was always there and paying attention to me, that's why. Right. Yeah.
Question there?
Yeah, with the exception of John Zander, I think you had an assignment from Sky. Am I correct in thinking that everybody's pretty much self-financed all this work because there are no magazine assignments or publications?
The Sky thing happened because I actually had 7 to 7, and I'm really interested in some of my youth, so it kind of tied in to the complicity. And I had all those meetings. So it was commissioned, but it was kind of me really making sure they actually did commission me to do it. And they commissioned it for a month. So 6 of 1, 1/2 dozen the other, I kind of took it further than I perhaps should have done had I been a really serious, pragmatic business journalist.
Right. And the other both that you're basically doing is just as a personal commitment, is that right?
Yeah, you're looking at it. Yeah, definitely.
Same.
I used to work for newspapers, and I really wouldn't know what to do if I didn't have book projects in mind now. You know, it's everything. If you can find a way to think about sponsors and stuff, then wonderful. And that seems to be where book publishing is going now. Trying to pre-sell large amounts of books through tie-ins and stuff is it's constant to try to think about how to finance work and how to do it. It's the 95% of the boring bit of your life, which is being a photographer, I suppose. You know, 5% shooting.
And there was a question over there.
Yeah,
last one.
It's just quite.
It better be good.
It's just quite a simple. It's quite a simple question actually. Is to Michael. How do you feel supported by the government? I mean, how do you feel when?
Not at all.
I mean, like, Gordon Brown spoke in Parliament today about, you know, well, I've got to make.
I don't really watch the news.
How do you feel when people talk about stuff like that? I mean, because obviously you've gone on to do like quite good stuff, and you're going to hopefully influence a lot of people.
I can't really say nothing about that because I don't watch the news. I don't know what Gordon Brown said. But
tell you that you said you met Boris Johnson last week. Tell him what's going to happen to Code 7 and what you said to him.
I met Boris Johnson a couple of weeks ago. Me and my manager, we went to Brixton Academy because our place is getting shut down, and our place is one of the best places where all the youth come. That's the only place you can find in London, I can say. Every different crew in the whole world come there and there's no trouble. But now they want to close it down because they think we are gang affiliated. That's where all the gang come. So we met Boris now. We was telling, but he was being rude. He didn't want to listen. But, you know, if he was just gangsters, we could have beat him up there. But, you know, we don't have gangsters. Let me. So we talked to him. Right now, I just came back from, we had a meeting with Lambeth, what's his name? Nick Griffin, and the rest of the police, all the big police. That's why I'm late. You know, I was telling them, you know what I mean? Like the youth are asking them questions of what they're doing wrong. So if they're saying our place is wrong, so why is the top police coming there and play with us? I don't know. I don't know what to say really. Actually, well,
it's the first. People in the media, the first person in the media to ever take you seriously was Adam.
Yeah. Very. Then my manager.
It was not Boris Johnson.
Forget Boris Johnson.
So,